Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Chuen with Medical Monday. The outrageous costs of U.S. healthcare continue to be a big story in 2019, as outlets like Kaiser Health News and NPR regularly featured individual stories of people getting gouged, often to great effect in getting those fees lowered or waived in the glare of the media spotlight. Echoing that theme, but demonstrating clever healthcare hacks framed from a viewpoint of self-defense, is season 3 of a wonderful podcast that we've featured here on Medical Monday before. It's called An Arm and a Leg, and it's created, produced, and hosted by my guest today, Dan Weissman. Dan is a veteran reporter for a long time at WBEZ in Chicago. He's also appeared on public radio shows like Marketplace, Morning Edition, and All Things Considered, as well as podcasts like 99% Invisible and Planet Money. Season 3 of An Arm and a Leg is nearing its conclusion, and if you've never heard it, I highly encourage you to check it out. It's funny, sometimes irreverent, and most of all, really informative about why healthcare is so expensive and what you can do to control your own costs, even if you have health insurance. You can find out everything you need to know at the show's website, armandalegshow.com. The podcast was listed last month by the New York Times as a show worth discovering. Dan Weissman, host and producer of An Arm and a Leg, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dan Weissman, welcome back to Medical Monday, and congratulations on season 3, which is nearing completion. And I guess let's just start by talking a little bit about this season, because some of the episodes, well, all of them have been interesting, but a couple have really stuck out. I wanted to start by asking you about an episode about a hospital in Memphis and an intrepid reporter there named Wendy Thomas. Give us some broad brushstrokes of what happened there. That was just so shocking.
It's amazing, yeah. So Wendy Thomas is a reporter in Memphis, and she runs a kind of bootstrapped or initially bootstrapped nonprofit reporting outfit called MLK 50, named for the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination in Memphis. And she discovered that the biggest hospital in town was suing enormous numbers of patients. She kind of got wind that something like this might be happening. She just showed up at the courthouse and could see that they were suing tons and tons of people. In fact, there was a courtroom essentially reserved for just their cases one morning a week, week in, week out. And she got ProPublica, a big national nonprofit newsroom, to back her efforts for a year because she knew it was going to be a giant project. And so she dug in for a year-long reporting project and found that they had sued something like a little more than 8,000 people over a five-year span, including many of their own poorly paid employees. And, you know, people were just completely outmatched. You know, the people they were suing were people who didn't have money to pay their hospital bill. And they would be called into court. And the hospital, of course, had attorneys who were there week in, week out, knew the judge very, very well, and knew exactly how all this worked. Whereas, like most of us, the people being called into court to answer these lawsuits, you know, I've never been a defendant in a lawsuit. Have you?
Fortunately not.
Yeah, right. Fortunately. And, you know, I would want a lawyer with me. But, like, if the problem is that you owe the hospital a few thousand dollars and you can't pay them, where are you going to get money to pay a lawyer to defend you? So this seemed quite egregious to her. And so she very doggedly, one, documented everything that was going on through pulling court records and analyzing them and by just showing up and witnessing what was happening. And then, two, it took a lot of doing to find people who would talk about their experience. Because as Wendy Thomas, the reporter, says, like, there's a lot of shame.
Yeah, that was really, you know, surprising to me, because it seems like we're based on things like your show, for example, we're having kind of a moment in the country around medical bills and surprise medical bills at that and egregious medical bills. And yet she had a really hard time finding people who were willing to go on the record to talk about the fact that they were in collections and being sued, even though you'd think people might see her as an advocate, but they were maybe a little suspicious and more, like you say, embarrassed.
Yeah, I don't get the sense that people were suspicious of her. But I do think that, again, like, if you've never had your name in the newspaper before, if you have been living under the burden of this debt for a long time, this doesn't seem like the way I would want to become known to the world necessarily. I can sympathize with that. And you might fear that there would be repercussions. You know, one person pointed out to me later that also, you know, pretty much all of the defendants, she said, that she witness. She said she could count on her fingers and toes of the thousands of defendants that she saw, the number who were not African American. And, you know, Memphis is a southern city. And there's, and at least one person speculated that, like, being an individual with obviously no means, who's African American in a southern city, sticking your neck out, putting your name to a story, calling out a big institution in town, may not feel like the safest thing to do.
Yeah. And I mean, she hit a home run, Wendy Thomas, because what changed after her stories started coming out?
Oh, man. It was amazing. It was fantastic. You know, within a couple of months, the hospital announced, like within a week or two, the hospital said, like, we're going to take a look at our practices. They felt the heat right away. And within a short amount of time, she published her stories at the end of June. And by mid-September, the hospital had announced, like, okay, we've done our review. And guess what? We're dropping these lawsuits. They dropped thousands and thousands of lawsuits. And they said, we're not going to sue any. We're going to cease, you know, doing this thing of suing people. They also, interestingly, announced they were raising their minimum wage. I mean, one of the things that she noted was that, you know, they were suing more than 160 of their own employees among the folks they were suing. And that they pay people as little as $10 an hour. And they were like, effective pretty much immediately, we're raising our minimum wage to $13.50, I think it was. And it's going up to $15 an hour by early 2021. So that was that by itself was kind of a victory. And yeah, they just stopped altogether doing this. So that's a huge deal. And then the follow-up was great that she documented a couple months after that in November, between the time I interviewed her in late October and the time our story aired in December, she had gotten ready to publish the results of another investigation of what's called a physician staffing firm that provided the ER docs to another great big hospital in town. Because as is a fairly common practice, the physician staffing firm, the doctors who practice at the ER don't work for the hospital. They work for this independent physician staffing company that doesn't take insurance. And so the bills can be quite large, even relative to other medical bills. And insurance isn't covering much of it. And they were suing, she had documented, they were suing thousands of people. And so she called them and she was like, I'm doing this story about you. And before she published it, they were like, you know, we're going to take a look at that. And they dropped tons and tons of lawsuits and said they wouldn't do it anymore. So the story she published was like, they were suing all these people and then we called them and now they're not. So yeah, I'd say she hit like a pair of
moments. Yeah, I mean, it really was just a breathtaking episode. And again, I guess showed the power of investigative journalism done well. And, you know, the theme of your season has really been self-defense. And here was an example of an advocate, really for the poor and the somewhat disenfranchised who was advocating on their behalf, who was able to make really some systematic change.
Yeah, she was able to be super, super effective. It was, you know, I took great heart in it. And, you know, we see examples of reporters calling out individual cases and sometimes getting results. I had this experience. There was a couple whose insurance company had basically dropped them for reasons that were, as it turned out, just this side of legal, when they were 6 months pregnant. And then they'd been hospitalized and they had $10,000, $15,000 worth of hospital bills that they were essentially going to be on the hook for. And they eventually got back on insurance. But they were, when I interviewed them a few months, you know, into this whole ordeal, they still had all these bills that were unresolved. And when I called their insurance company that had dropped them and said, I'd like your comment, the insurance company said, we'll call you back tomorrow. And before they called me back, I heard from the couple and they said, guess who just called us? And that company had called them to say, we're going to reinstate you retroactively. And how can we make this right? And so I've had that experience too. But, you know, there are just not enough reporters to go around. You know, that was one story. That was one couple. And I knew from the little bit of reporting I'd done that there were other people in similar situations with that same insurance company in that same city. And that's just, again, it was just happenstance that I happened to catch that story. You know, you multiply it by zillions and zillions of times. So when you see a reporter like Wendy Thomas, who's able to catch something happening at scale and has the skill and the dedication and also the skill to find the resources to allow her to do all of the follow-up, to document that kind of practice and publicize it and put it down unmistakably, it's a big deal. Wendy Thomas says she's inspired by a professor who she met when she did a fellowship at Harvard who said to encourage students to think about poverty not as an accident, but as a robbery.
Hmm.
And she says, you know, I believe that. And if poverty is a robbery, then there are thieves. And the thieves can be named. And that that is what she's undertaking to do.
And that's episode 6 of this current season, season 3 of An Arm and a Leg Show. And you're listening to Medical Monday on Studio Tulsa. I'm John Chu. And my guest today is Dan Weissman, who is the creator and host of An Arm and a Leg podcast, the show about the insane costs of healthcare. And this season really dedicated to self-defense, what individuals and groups can do to handle outrageous medical bills or debt. And it's really is a, you have such a great spirit and sense of humor that really takes what could be otherwise dry and even sad and heartbreaking stories, and you find these rays of positivity and do a great job reporting them. Another episode that was, I think, equally fascinating was about a family in near Cincinnati who had had this sort of memorial softball game for their beloved father who died way too young. I think in his 20s of lymphoma, I think it was, and they had this ongoing fundraiser, and they decided to get serious when the original organizers of the game, and they were just small kids, so they didn't really organize it, but they took it over and realized if they were going to be serious about it, they needed to have a cause. And it was surprising sort of what cause they chose to dedicate their fundraising to. Can you tell us about that story?
Yeah, Denny Bueller was, I think, 24 when he died of leukemia about 40 years ago. And only one of his three, he had three kids, only one of whom was old enough to, you know, still have memories of him now. And Denny went to Seattle for a bone marrow transplant. And his family and friends organized a softball tournament to raise money for his expenses, like traveling to Seattle and having a place to stay there and stuff like that. And softball tournaments were very big in this little Cincinnati suburb where they lived. And as it happened, he died. The bone marrow transplant was a success, but he died of pneumonia a few months later. And the following summer, those same group of people who were all in their 20s, as far as I know, were like, you know, we're going to organize another softball tournament to help somebody else out, basically to remember Denny. And they this time it was for somebody who'd been in a motorcycle accident. They just kept doing it year after year for more than 20 years, for 25 years. Every summer they held a softball tournament to raise money for somebody who needed money because of a big medical episode. And after 25 years, they were no longer a group of friends in their mid-20s. They were now, you know, like 50 years old, and they'd raised their kids. And, you know, they'd done their bit. And they were like, this has been a great run. And by that time, Denny Bueller's kids were in their 20s. And this was not this thing that they had, you know, done for this period of their lives. This was a thing that had been going on their entire lives, a thing that was an opportunity for their family, which had struggled, to be leaders every year and to kind of celebrate their family and their legacy. So those kids in their mid-20s, no longer kids, said, like, we're going to take this over. And they did. And it was, you know, that was one adventure. And after a few years, once they kind of got the hang of it, they decided they wanted to kind of make it official. And they formed a foundation around it. And they decided they wanted to find a way to make a bigger difference than just running the softball tournament. And it took them a while, but when they figured it out, it kind of crystallized quickly. A few years ago, John Oliver, the comedian, on his HBO show Last Week Tonight, did a segment that I remember about medical debt. And in it, he outlined how, you know, if you are hearing from a collection agency, especially if you're hearing from a collection agency about an old debt, that agency is not representing whoever originally, you know, you incurred the debt to. Like, say, a hospital. Whoever you incurred that debt to eventually kind of gave up on getting that money from you and sold it to somebody else. They sold the right to collect on it to somebody else. And that debt changes hands multiple times over the years. Each time it gets sold for a bigger and bigger discount because people figure they're less and less likely to collect. And so eventually that debt can be sold for like pennies on the dollar. But what you're buying if you buy that debt is the right to collect on it in full. Right. So if someone's chasing you for $10,000, they might have paid $100 or less for the right to collect that money from you. But that doesn't mean they can't call you every day. And that doesn't mean it doesn't stay on your credit report. So, you know, people fight this for years and years and years. What he did was in order to demonstrate not just how egregious it was and the fact this happened, but how little was required, how little regulation there was that in his fashion, like he does, he formed a debt collection company and bought a bunch of debt. He bought $15 million worth of debt for $60,000. And then he said, you know, what we thought we would do is essentially give it away to forgive this debt. And he worked with a nonprofit organization called RIP Medical Debts, which specializes in doing exactly this. And at the time, they were very poorly known, but they became a lot better known after John Oliver worked with them to forgive $15 million in medical debt. And one of the people who saw it was Jenny Spring, the oldest child of Denny Bueller. And she, it kind of came to her like, we could do what John Oliver did. And she pitched her family and their colleagues on the board of this nonprofit they'd founded. They were like, yes, we'll do this. And so over the course of basically last year, they raised about $12,000, which was enough to purchase a portfolio of $1 million worth of medical debt from people in the Cincinnati area. And one of the things that RIP Medical Debt does is they actually work with one of the credit reporting agencies to kind of examine the finances of the people who are in this debt. And they, when they are choosing debts that they want to buy and forgive, they choose the debts of people who could really use a hand. So, you know, this is $1 million worth of debt from people who really could use a hand that this small group of people, in addition, who still run this softball tournament every year, you know, they essentially held, they like ran a brunch at a local bar that, you know, let them kind of, you know, charge admission. And they made little tchotchkes for the holiday season and did everything they could think of to just ask their friends and neighbors for a dollar here and a dollar there and raise this $12,000 to be able to forgive $1 million worth of debt.
Again, the scale is just epic. I mean, you're talking about literally pennies on the dollar and the impact that that can have on people who've wrestled with this debt, going to collections, being harassed for what may be fair debts, what fair bills, but what may be egregious bills, because you have a whole nother episode about the fact that what could be a quote-unquote routine bill for $35 can get jacked up to $1,300 simply by going into being a little bit overdue and not making any kind of arrangement to pay it. I mean, it's this exorbitant, almost usurious type of overcharging that can lead to people just absolutely, understandably, perhaps panicking and thinking, well, there's no way I can pay this.
Yeah, it's a vicious cycle in that way. Yeah, that was a story that prompted the title of the segment that I think we'll do again is, like, can they freaking do that? This woman had gotten a bill for $35. It was from a lab that she'd had no personal contact with. Like, she had gone for an appointment, gotten some tests done, you know, gotten a bill from the clinic where she'd gone to, paid that bill, paid the part that wasn't covered by insurance, and then got this other bill, you know, from this other lab where apparently the original clinic had outsourced some work. She didn't know. It was for $35. It smelled fishy to her. And then the follow-up said, if you don't pay this on time, it's going to go up to $1,300. Yeah, which caused her to both think this couldn't possibly be legitimate and, very unwisely, what she chose to do was to ignore it, which, as you say, it's like a totally understandable thing to do. It's like, how can this be happening? And I think some people have speculated that people, there's elements of this whole world that in some ways rely on people, you know, panicking and not responding. I mean, what ended up happening in her case was she heard from a collection agency that was like, we'd like that $1,300. And she got her dad to negotiate with them and talked them down to $217, I think the number was, which was, you know, 1/6 of the $1,300 they were asking for. But it was 6 times the original $35 bill. And, you know, this is an example of the kind of debt that people sometimes get taken to court for. And what folks have said about these lawsuits is that the people bringing the lawsuits, the collections folks bringing the lawsuits, count on people panicking, not showing up, not knowing what to do. Because if you don't show up to court and if you don't contest this, then whoever holds that debt can go to the judge and say, well, judge, you have to, we're asking you for permission to garnish this person's wages. Or in some cases, put a lien on their house or take money directly from their bank account, all of which happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, it happens in part because people don't have the know-how and the wherewithal to respond, but also because it's like knowing that they don't have that, people allow themselves to kind of get what's called a default judgment against them.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Dan Weissman, who is the creator and host of Arm and a Leg, the show about the costs of healthcare. And his motto is, we may be screwed, but we're together. So let's talk. He tells outrageous stories about healthcare costs. And he's got a great website, Arm and a Leg Show, one word, armandalegshow.com. And there you can link to episodes or read his newsletters or even contribute if you have a story about an outrageous bill or something that's happened to you in healthcare. And Dan, I just got to ask you about that. You're now in your third season, plans underway for a fourth, and you are cranking this thing out. And you have a long history as a reporter. You've reported for Marketplace, for WBEZ and Chicago Public Media, but you've done this pretty much all on your own. And I mean, when you talk about, I've heard you on a couple of the episodes talk about bootstrapping various enterprises, but you've really done this yourself. How did you know you could pull it off?
I had no idea. It's still a work in progress. It's still a work in progress, for sure. I've been super, super lucky. And, you know, my family was in a position where we could take a gamble on this and have me do this for a little while without necessarily relying on it for a salary. You know, I was planning, as we did this, at a moment when I was looking at a career transition anyway. So we thought there might be a little while where we needed to float me. And so we decided to try this instead. So that's one thing. A second is, at the end of our first season, the folks from a group called Kaiser Health News said they wanted to collaborate with us, which is great. And they share a name with a very famous entity in healthcare, Kaiser Permanente, which, you know, runs a hospital system and an insurance outfit on the West Coast for the most part. But they're not connected except by a common ancestor, this guy Henry J. Kaiser, who had his hands on a lot of things. And but Kaiser Health News is a terrific news organization, and they've supported us financially to a degree. They provided editorial guidance. And we've also asked listeners directly for support using a website called Patreon. And, you know, so far, more than 450 people have signed up to make, you know, modest monthly pledges to support the show. So we're figuring it out. You know,
What's been the biggest surprise, besides the fact that maybe early on or even after season one, that Kaiser Health News decided you were worthy of them collaborating with you? Is it just that the public has just this outpouring of stories that people have shared of these insane bills and healthcare experiences? Or is it more the community you've created? Or what are some of the best surprises?
Yeah, it's been super gratifying that people have definitely hundreds of people have sent in stories and hundreds of people have volunteered to support us financially. The two things I think that are the nicest surprises come right to mind is, one is, from the beginning, among the people I hear from a lot of doctors. I hear from a lot of nurses. I hear from people who work in insurance. I hear from people in hospital administration who say, I'm so glad you're doing this. I'm learning from what you're doing. I'm encouraged by what you're doing. I'm frustrated by this too. You know, which shouldn't be surprising. I mean, people become doctors, become nurses, you know, participate in healthcare as a profession because they want to help people. And, you know, they didn't choose to kind of get involved in what turns out to be an industry where there's all these kind of financial shenanigans, right? That's a side issue. That's not why people chose to get involved. But it's been super encouraging to hear from so many. I hear so often from people who are doing their best to be, you know, healers and find themselves frustrated at what the people they're trying to help go through. And at the way in which all the kind of financial shenanigans interfere with their efforts. So that's been really, really heartening. Most recently, just in the last few days, there's also just been this evidence that people are taking the information that we're putting out and putting it to use. So in the story about the woman who got the $35 bill, I investigated that wanted to turn into a $1,300 bill. You know, I had this question, like, can they freaking do that? And is there anything you can do about it? And what we found out was, well, they can definitely hit you up for that money. You have legal rights, and you can defend those rights. You can challenge those outrageous bills. And I talked to people who had done it successfully and got essentially a recipe from them for doing it. And, you know, one of the most encouraging things is, just a few days ago on Twitter, a woman from San Francisco posted, like, hey, you know, I'm fighting back against this healthcare system where I was out of town and my appendix blew up. I had to have an appendectomy. So it was all out of network. And my insurance company paid, of the $60,000 in charges, my insurance company paid $53,000. But now these people are coming after me for $7,000. And I have demanded an itemized bill and the billing codes, and I'm going through them and I'm figuring out, I'm using a website to figure out what the going rate is for each of those charges in my area, and I'm getting ready to contest all of them. And she listed some enormous whoppers. And in the middle of this Twitter thread, she was like, thank you to Arm and a Leg Show for teaching me how to do this. And she linked to our episode about can they freaking do that. And I was like, that is exactly, that is exactly what I hope that people will do.
That is just great. Right, that's so great to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about impact and direct impact of that. I mean, you're cranking this show out and like, you know, days to weeks to months later, just getting this kind of instant result. You know, I have to say, I am a doctor as well, and I would literally prescribe episode 8, which I think is the most recent episode, the one about back pain and the back pain industry. Yeah. And I'm totally going to get that book. It's called Crooked by, is it Catherine Raymond? Yeah.
Catherine Jacobson Raymond. Yeah.
I've already prescribed the episode to several family members who've had back pain to say, you just got to listen to this before you ever consider doing anything. Because one of the things that I've tried to explain to patients that I haven't been successful with, but she figured out as an investigative journalist was, you know, just getting an MRI, which seems like a reasonable first step when you have excruciating back pain, you're more likely to cause harm to yourself than you are to, you know, like if you took 100 people off the street, 33 of them have herniated discs, basically. It's just an artifact of aging. It's like our wrinkles in our skin, right? Or gray hair.
Yeah, it's not that those 33 people would say their backs were killing them. This is literally a thing that happens when someone's back is killing them, they might get an MRI that would show they have these artifacts, and it's a very logical, you know, leap to make to say like, oh, I must need surgery to correct those deficiencies. But in fact, as she found, that's not true. That what's happening when your back really goes out on you is a combination, I guess, of two things. And one is you're deconditioned, you're out of shape. There's muscles that, you know, haven't been getting the kind of work that they're supposed to get because we lead sedentary lives for the most part. And, you know, we have bad posture, we do other things. And then the other is there's a kind of brain component to it, I guess is the only way to put it, that like when your back seizes up on you, what's happening is your brain has gotten a signal that something's weird, you got a twinge, but that massive pain is a spasm that your brain is actually kind of ordered as a way of saying, we got to lock this down, we don't know what's going on, but there could be big trouble here. And the answer is generally there isn't big trouble. And as she points out, that like you give yourself some gentle exercises to do, you can send your brain the message that you're actually okay. But our first instinct is to not move. And that message is reinforced, I think, by what I'm tempted to call kind of what we now receive as common sense, where if you're in a lot of back pain, you know, well, maybe something's structurally wrong with your back and you better not move it or else you're going to cripple yourself. And people end up going in for substantial interventions, including surgery in many cases, where what they really need is a rigorous and highly tailored exercise program.
By and large, surgery is usually... you want it to be the very last resort. That was a takeaway from that. And the website is armandalegshow.com. It is created, produced, hosted by my guest today, Dan Weissman. And Dan, it's just such a great joy to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on.
With you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.